People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Welcome to one of our reading episodes while we are on hiatus. We're going to be on hiatus for a little bit, just getting ready for Season 8. And why not have some thoughts on H.P. Lovecraft's thoughts on supernatural fiction. So yeah, enjoy this several-part series on H.P. Lovecraft's thoughts on supernatural fiction. And hey, can't wait to see you in Season 8. All right. Thank you for listening to People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, brought to you by BunnySlippers.com, FoundItemClothing.com. Get some cool Cthulhu slippers, and maybe, I don't know, a t-shirt from one of those problematic yet cult films from the 80s that you love so much, but probably haven't watched in the last few years. And then when you do watch it with your girlfriend, you're like, oh, I don't remember that scene. The rest of it's pretty good, but I don't remember that scene. FoundItemClothing.com, BunnySlippers.com. All right, let's get going.
Section 1 of Supernatural Horror in Literature by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Piotr Natter. Introduction. The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. These facts few psychologists will dispute, and their admitted truth must establish for all time the genuineness and dignity of the weirdly horrible tale as a literary form. Against it are discharged all the shafts of a materialistic sophistication which clings to frequently felt emotions and external events, and of a naively insipid idealism which deprecates the aesthetic motive and calls for a didactic literature to uplift the reader toward a suitable degree of smirking optimism. But in spite of all this opposition, the weird tale has survived, developed, and attained remarkable heights of perfection, founded, as it is, on a profound and elementary principle whose appeal, if not always universal, must necessarily be poignant and permanent to minds of the requisite sensitiveness. The appeal of the spectrally macabre is generally narrow, because it demands from the reader a certain degree of imagination and a capacity for detachment from everyday life. Relatively few are free enough from the spell of the daily routine to respond to tappings from outside, and tales of ordinary feelings and events, or of common sentimental distortions of such feelings and events, will always take first place in the taste of the majority. Rightly, perhaps, since of course these ordinary matters make up the greater part of human experience. But the sensitive are always with us, and sometimes a curious streak of fancy invades an obscure corner of the very hardest head, so that no amount of rationalization, reform, or Freudian analysis can quite annul the thrill of the chimney corner whisper or the lonely wood. There is here involved a psychological pattern or tradition as real and as deeply grounded in mental experience as any other pattern or tradition of mankind, coeval with the religious feeling and closely related to many aspects of it, and too much a part of our innermost biological heritage to lose keen potency over a very important, though not numerically great, minority of our species. Man's first instincts and emotions formed his response to the environment in which he found himself. Definite feelings, based on pleasure and pain, grew up around the phenomena whose causes and effects he understood, whilst around those which he did not understand, and the universe teemed with them in the early days, were naturally woven such personifications, marvelous interpretations and sensations of awe and fear, as would be hit upon by a race having few and simple ideas and limited experience. The unknown, being likewise the unpredictable, became for our primitive forefathers a terrible and omnipotent source of boons and calamities, visited upon mankind for cryptic and wholly extraterrestrial reasons, and thus clearly belonging to spheres of existence whereof we know nothing and wherein we have no part. The phenomenon of dreaming likewise helped to build up the notion of an unreal or spiritual world, and in general, all the conditions of savage dawn life so strongly conduce toward a feeling of the supernatural that we need not wonder at the thoroughness with which man's very hereditary essence has become saturated with religion and superstition. This saturation must, as a matter of plain scientific fact, be regarded as virtually permanent, so far as the subconscious mind and inner instincts are concerned. For though the area of the unknown has been steadily contracting for thousands of years, an infinite reservoir of mystery still engulfs most of the outer cosmos, whilst a vast residuum of powerful inherited associations clings round all the objects and processes that were once mysterious, however well they may now be explained. And more than this, there is an actual physiological fixation of the old instincts in our nervous tissue, which would make them obscurely operative, even were the conscious mind to be purged of all sources of wonder. Because we remember pain and the menace of death more vividly than pleasure, and because our feelings toward the beneficent aspects of the unknown have from the first been captured and formalized by conventional religious rituals, it has fallen to the lot of the darker and more maleficent side of cosmic mystery to figure chiefly in our popular supernatural folklore. This tendency, too, is naturally enhanced by the fact that uncertainty and danger are always closely allied, thus making any kind of an unknown world a world of peril and evil possibilities. When to this sense of fear and evil the inevitable fascination of wonder and curiosity is superadded, there is born a composite body of keen emotion and imaginative provocation, whose vitality must of necessity endure as long as the human race itself. Children will always be afraid of the dark, and men with minds sensitive to hereditary impulse will always tremble at the thought of the hidden and fathomless worlds of strange life which may pulsate in the gulfs beyond the stars, or press hideously upon our own globe in unholy dimensions, which only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. With this foundation, no one need wonder at the existence of a literature of cosmic fear. It has always existed, and always will exist, and no better evidence of its tenacious vigor can be cited than the impulse which now and then drives writers of totally opposite leanings to try their hands at it in isolated tales, as if to discharge from their minds certain phantasmal shapes which would otherwise haunt them. Thus Dickens wrote several eerie narratives, Browning the hideous poem Childe Roland, Henry James The Turn of the Screw, Dr. Holmes the subtle novel Elsie Venner, F. Marion Crawford, The Upper Berth, and a number of other examples, Mrs. Charlotte Perkins Gilman, social worker, The Yellow Wallpaper, whilst the humorist W. W. Jacobs produced that able melodramatic bit called The Monkey's Paw. This type of fear literature must not be confounded with a type externally similar but psychologically widely different, the literature of mere physical fear and the mundanely gruesome. Such writing, to be sure, has its place, as has the conventional or even whimsical or humorous ghost story, where formalism or the author's knowing wink removes the true sense of the morbidly unnatural. But these things are not the literature of cosmic fear in its purest sense. The true weird tale has something more than secret murder, bloody bones, or a sheeted form clanking chains according to rule. A certain atmosphere of breathless and unexplainable dread of outer unknown forces must be present, and there must be a hint, expressed with a seriousness and portentousness becoming its subject, of that most terrible conception of the human brain, a malign and particular suspension or defeat of those fixed laws of nature, which are our only safeguard against the assaults of chaos and the demons of unplumbed space. Naturally, we cannot expect all weird tales to conform absolutely to any theoretical model. Creative minds are uneven, and the best of fabrics have their dull spots. Moreover, much of the choicest weird work is unconscious, appearing in memorable fragments scattered through material whose massed effect may be of a very different cast. Atmosphere is the all-important thing, for the final criterion of authenticity is not the dovetailing of a plot, but the creation of a given sensation. We may say, as a general thing, that a weird story whose intent is to teach or produce a social effect, or one in which the horrors are finally explained away by natural means, is not a genuine tale of cosmic fear. But it remains a fact that such narratives often possess, in isolated sections, atmospheric touches which fulfill every condition of true supernatural horror literature. Therefore, we must judge a weird tale not by the author's intent or by the mere mechanics of the plot, but by the emotional level which it attains at its least mundane point. If the proper sensations are excited, such a high spot must be admitted on its own merits as weird literature, no matter how prosaically it is later dragged down. The one test of the really weird is simply this, whether or not there be excited in the reader a profound sense of dread and of contact with unknown spheres and powers, a subtle attitude of awed listening, as if for the beating of black wings or the scratching of outside shapes and entities on the known universe's utmost rim. And of course, the more completely and unifiedly a story conveys this atmosphere, the better it is as a work of art in the given medium. The Dawn of the Horror Tale. As may naturally be expected of a form so closely connected with primal emotion, the horror tale is as old as human thought and speech themselves. Cosmic terror appears as an ingredient of the earliest folklore of all races, and is crystallized in the most archaic ballads, chronicles, and sacred writings. It was indeed a prominent feature of the elaborate ceremonial magic, with its rituals for the evocation of demons and specters, which flourished from prehistoric times, and which reached its highest development in Egypt and the Semitic nations. Fragments like the Book of Enoch and the Clavicula of Solomon well illustrate the power of the weird over the ancient Eastern mind, and upon such things were based enduring systems and traditions, whose echoes extend obscurely even to the present time. Touches of this transcendental fear are seen in classic literature, and there is evidence of its still greater emphasis in the ballad literature, which paralleled the classic stream but vanished for lack of a written medium. The Middle Ages, steeped in fanciful darkness, gave it an enormous impulse toward expression, and East and West alike were busy preserving and amplifying the dark heritage, both of random folklore and of academically formulated magic and cabalism, which had descended to them. Witch, werewolf, vampire, and ghoul brooded ominously on the lips of bards and grandam, and needed but little encouragement to take the final step across the boundary that divides chanted tale or song from the formal literary composition. In the Orient, the weird tale tended to assume a gorgeous coloring and sprightliness which almost transmuted it into sheer fantasy. In the West, where the mystical Teuton had come down from his black boreal forest, and the Celt remembered strange sacrifices in druidic groves, it assumed a terrible intensity and convincing seriousness of atmosphere, which doubled the force of its half-told, half-hinted horrors. Much of the power of Western horror lore was undoubtedly due to the hidden, but often suspected presence of a hideous cult of nocturnal worshippers, whose strange customs descended from pre-Aryan and pre-agricultural times, when a squat race of Mongoloids roved over Europe with their flocks and herds, were rooted in the most revolting fertility rites of immemorial antiquity. This secret religion, stealthily handed down amongst peasants for thousands of years, despite the outward reign of the Druidic, Greco-Roman, and Christian faiths in the regions involved, was marked by wild witches' sabbaths in lonely woods and atop distant hills on Walpurgis night and Halloween, the traditional breeding season of the goats and sheep and cattle, and became the source of vast riches of sorcery legend, beside provoking extensive witchcraft prosecution, of which the Salem affair forms the chief American example. Akin to it in essence, and perhaps connected with it in fact, was the frightful secret system of inverted theology or Satan worship, which produced such horrors as the famous Black Mass, whilst operating toward the same end we may note the activities of those whose aims were somewhat more scientific or philosophical, the astrologers, cabalists, and alchemists of the Albertus Magnus or Raymond Lully type, with whom such rude ages invariably abound. The prevalence and depth of the medieval horror spirit in Europe, intensified by the dark despair which waves of pestilence brought, may be fairly gauged by the grotesque carvings slyly introduced into much of the finest later ecclesiastical work of the time, the demoniac gargoyles of Notre Dame and Mont Saint-Michel being among the most famous specimens. And throughout the period, it must be remembered there existed amongst educated and uneducated alike a most unquestioning faith in every form of the supernatural, from the gentlest doctrines of Christianity to the most monstrous morbidities of witchcraft and black magic. It was from no empty background that the Renaissance magicians and alchemists, Nostradamus, Tristemius, Dr. John Dee, Robert Fludd, and the like, were born. In this fertile soil were nourished types and characters of somber myth and legend, which persist in weird literature to this day, more or less disguised or altered by modern technique. Many of them were taken from the earliest oral sources and form part of mankind's permanent heritage. The shade which appears and demands the burial of its bones, the demon lover who comes to bear away his still living bride, the death fiend or psychopomp riding the night ride, the man-wolf, the sealed chamber, the deathless sorcerer, all these may be found in that curious body of medieval lore which the late Mr. Baring Gould so effectively assembled in book form. Wherever the mystic northern blood was strongest, the atmosphere of the popular tales became most intense, for in the Latin races there is a touch of basic rationality which denies to even their strangest superstitions many of the overtones of glamour, so characteristic of our own forest-born and ice-fostered whisperings. Just as all fiction first found extensive embodiment in poetry, so is it in poetry that we first encounter the permanent entry of the weird into standard literature. Most of the ancient instances, curiously enough, are in prose, as the werewolf incident in Petronius,
the gruesome passages in Apuleius,
the brief but celebrated letter of Pliny the Younger to Sura, and the odd compilation on wonderful events by the Emperor Hadrian's Greek freedman Phlegon. It is in Phlegon that we first find that hideous tale of the corpse bride, Pinion and Mahates, later related by Proclus, and in modern times forming an inspiration of Goethe's Bride of Corinth and Washington Irving's German Student. But by the time the old northern myths take literary form, and in that later time, when the weird appears as a steady element in the literature of the day, we find it mostly in metrical dress, as indeed we find the greater part of the strictly imaginative writing of the Middle Ages and Renaissance. The Scandinavian Eddas and Sagas thunder with cosmic horror, and shake with the stark fear of Ymir and his shapeless spawn, whilst our own Anglo-Saxon Beowulf and later continental Nibelung tales are full of eldritch weirdness. Dante is a pioneer in the classic capture of macabre atmosphere, and in Spenser's stately stanzas will be seen more than a few touches of fantastic terror in landscape, incident and character. Prose literature gives us Malory's Mort d'Arthur, in which are presented many ghastly situations taken from early ballad sources. The theft of the sword and silk from the corpse in Chapel Perilous by Sir Galahad, whilst other and cruder specimens were doubtless set forth in the cheap and sensational chapbooks, vulgarly hawked about and devoured by the ignorant. In Elizabethan drama, with its Dr. Faustus, the witches in Macbeth, the ghost in Hamlet, and the horrible gruesomeness of Webster, we may easily discern the strong hold of the demoniac on the public mind, a hold intensified by the very real fear of living witchcraft, whose terrors, wildest at first on the continent, begin to echo loudly in English ears, as the witch-hunting crusaders of James I gain headway. To the lurking mystical prose of the ages is added a long line of treatises on witchcraft and demonology, which aid in exciting the imagination of the reading world. Through the 17th and into the 18th century, we behold a growing mass of fugitive legendary and balladry of darksome cast, still, however, held down beneath the surface of polite and accepted literature. Chapbooks of horror and weirdness multiplied, and we glimpse the eager interest of the people through fragments like Defoe's Apparition of Mrs. Veal, a homely tale of a dead woman's spectral visit to a distant friend, written to advertise covertly a badly selling theological disquisition on death. The upper orders of society were now losing faith in the supernatural and indulging in a period of classic rationalism. Then, beginning with the translation of Eastern tales in Queen Anne's reign and taking definite form toward the middle of the century, comes the revival of romantic feeling, the era of new joy in nature and in the radiance of past times, strange scenes, bold deeds, and incredible marvels. We feel it first in the poets,
whose utterances take on new qualities of wonder, strangeness, and shuddering. And finally, after the timid appearance of a few weird scenes in the novels of the day, such as Smollett's Adventures of Ferdinand Count Fathom, the release instinct precipitates itself in the birth of a new school of writing, the Gothic school of horrible and fantastic prose fiction, long and short, whose literary posterity is destined to become so numerous and, in many cases, so resplendent in artistic merit. It is, when one reflects upon it, genuinely remarkable that weird narration as a fixed and academically recognized literary form should have been so late of final birth. The impulse and atmosphere are as old as man, but the typical weird tale of standard literature is a child of the 18th century. End of section 2.